Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, teching for us today.
Trying to, anyway.
Today's program we entitled Vegans on the Hot Seat, Ray Sikora and Gary Francione Responds. Today's program we're going to be dealing with some of the commonly asked questions to vegans and other people who are interested in animal rights. There's sort of a set of questions that I think probably a lot of people who are vegan or vegetarian and who are interested in animal rights face on a semi-frequent basis from skeptics. So this is a show for those folks, but it's also for the skeptics out there who maybe have some of these questions too on the tips of their tongues. So we're going to speak with Gary Francione and Ray Sikora, as I mentioned, and I'll just give you a little bit of background about who these folks are. Ray Sikora is human rights, animal rights, and environmental educator. She's been involved with these issues for about 25 years now. She is also the co-founder of the Center for Compassionate Living and the Institute for Humane Education. And she is also the founder of Simply Enough, an organization that promotes peace, critical thinking, and creativity. And we're also speaking today with Professor Francione, who is a distinguished professor of law and the Nicholas Dibby Katzenbach Scholar of Law and Philosophy at Rutgers University. He's the author of many books, including a new book called Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation. He's also the professor of many different animal rights and law courses over the years. And we've had both Ray and Gary on the program before a couple of times. So if you're interested in hearing more about them on the program, you can go to our website, animalvoices.ca, where there's archive shows with them, as well as with many guests from over the years. We have over 203 shows now archived on the Animal Voices website. If you have any questions or comments for us, you can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. And before we go into that interview, which will not be a debate show, we're just going to be asking the questions straight up to hear some good responses. Before we do that, we're going to hear from Carl, who's going to give us an announcement.
Yeah, I just I got an email this morning, actually, from the Wild at Heart folks. And we had actually announced this a couple weeks ago, but we'll give a reminder. There is a Shrine Circus demo that's happening this Friday, July 20th. It's actually a joint event, so it should be a good turnout, and that's no reason to stay at home. You should go check it out for sure. It is being put on in conjunction with Wild at Heart, ARC 2, and ZooCheck. So again, it's Friday, July 20th. They will be protesting the Shrine Circus demo at the East York Town Center, 45 Overlead Boulevard, from 5:45 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. If you need more information, you can check out Wild at Heart's website at www.wildatheart-online.com. And they're also on Facebook or MySpace and all those other wonderful places. We're on Facebook too.
We never mentioned that.
Join our group. We're fun.
So we're going to take a short break. Carl's going to work his magic and get Gary and Ray on the line. And then we're going to come back with Vegans on the Hot Seat, Ray Sikora and Gary Francione. It'll be an interesting show. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices CIUT 89.5 FM. Today's program is entitled Vegans on the Hot Seat, Ray Sikora and Gary Francione Respond. I'll give you a brief overview of what we're trying to accomplish on today's program. We're speaking with these two very respected authors, activists, teachers, about some of the commonly asked questions to vegans and other people who are interested in animal rights. There's certainly a litany of questions that people lob at vegans and vegetarians. And we wanted to make sure that we were providing some kind of oral resource for people to either hear those responses in some kind of coherent, good way, as well as, for people who are skeptical themselves about some of these questions and want to know more. So it's my pleasure to welcome Ray and Gary.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you both on the program again.
Great. Hi, Ray. How are you?
Hi, Gary.
So I think this will be a fun program, and we're going to limit you both, unfortunately. We decided that we would put a time limit on your answers just because we're trying to get through a number of different questions. And looking through Gary's book, Introduction to Animal Rights, Your Child or the Dog, and his appendix, called 20 Questions and Answers, which inspired this program, we realized that we're just simply not going to be able to get through all the questions that are commonly asked. So that's kind of unfortunate. But we'll limit you to about 2 to 3 minutes each. And if you do want to respond to each other a little bit, that's fine. But we'll probably keep the show going at a pretty good clip.
Sounds good.
Let me just say, our dogs are here, and the likelihood that this show will go to its conclusion without some barking is very, very small. I apologize, but there's really nothing I can do about it.
No, I think that's fine. And actually, an interview with Ray a while ago, I think it was Ray's dog that was barking.
Yeah, that's why the show's called Animal Voices.
Exactly. I think having those voices interrupt us, I think is perfect. So
well, we've got 5 dogs, so there's like 3 of us against 5 of them. They win.
All right. Well, we'll keep that in mind. You know, it's funny because people have asked me over the years, you know, are you going to interview? This is one of the commonly asked questions that's posed to me is, are you going to interview animals? And of course we're and animals as well. But yeah, I would love to interview your dogs sometime. Wonder what they'd say about you guys. So let's start off then with probably the most basic question. I'm not sure if this is the most common, but we'll...
Lauren, can I pipe in for
one
second? Is there a way to turn up Gary's voice for me? Because he sounds like he's a very tiny little speck of dust in the distance. I can't
quite
hear
him. I'll try.
I can hardly hear Ray.
Okay, I'll try and do what I can.
We'll all be yelling at each other by the end of it, I'm sure.
Then I'll say, could you turn down Gary? He'll say, could you turn Ray down?
Yeah. Okay, well, sorry about that, guys. Okay, so today's program, speaking with Gary Francione and Ray Sikora, and we're going to be giving them some of the common questions that are asked to vegans and animal rights people. So the first question that I want to ask is, why are you vegan? And we'll start off with Ray.
Wow, why I am vegan. It has, you know, a long history to it for me. Originally, when I became vegetarian, I was 15 years old, and someone just, you know, hit me with the question of, you know, I was telling my friend not to buy leather in a leather shop, and I think I've told you this story, Lauren, and I was telling her, oh, don't buy leather, that's bad animals, and the woman in the shop said, oh, do you eat meat? And I had just eaten a hot dog before we went in there. And it clicked for me at 15. Oh, I can't eat them anymore. And so I just stopped right then, and I answered the woman in the shop, no, I don't eat meat, even though I had just eaten this hot dog. But I never ate meat again after that. But the dairy and eggs took a little while for me to get to that. It took about 6 more years. And what happened was I heard this bellowing going on at the farm next to where I was living, and it was actually my landlord's farm and big dairy farm, and I got on my mountain bike and I went over there, and when I got there, there was a semi there and a man I didn't recognize, and they were loading up male calves, quite a few male calves, and I asked the landlord what was going on, and he said, oh, you know, don't get upset, you know, we just, you know, taking away the calves. And I said, taking them where? And he said, well, you know, this load is going, and he said the name of the town, and I said, well, why are they going there? And he said, well, there's a veal facility there. So these were going to a veal facility, and sometimes they just go to slaughter, he explained to me. I said, and the sound I'm hearing? He said, well, that's just the mothers. And I said, can I go see them? And he said, yeah, you know, just go around the barn, and, you know, don't be upset. They'll get over it in a few days. And what I saw when I rounded the corner was these mothers with their mouths wide open bellowing and pressed against the barbed wire trying to get to these calves that were being taken away and pressing so hard. Some of them had blood on their chest from the barbed wire. And it was a horrifying scene, and I never got it out of my head, and I came around the barn and I said, well, you know, I wish I hadn't seen what I saw. I'm glad I did see what I saw. I can't support this industry anymore. And that was it for me. And then I learned about eggs, and you know, I think that it's about, oh, once we learn about something, how can we not be responsible for our part in it? And so for me, it was very clear when I saw that I could not take part in that industry again. I couldn't support dairy industry again. And when I learned about egg production, I couldn't support that.
Gary, why are you vegan?
Well, I think that if you take animal interests seriously at all, if you regard animals as members of the moral community, logical and moral distinction between eating flesh and eating dairy or eggs or anything like that. It's all the same. There's probably more suffering in a glass of milk or a piece of cheese than there is in a piece of steak. And in any event, it's all the same. It's all the same exploitation. And there really is no logical or moral line that you can draw. I mean, when I meet people who tell me, well, I'm a vegetarian, but I'm not a vegan, I often discuss with them things like, well, how is that any different from saying, well, you eat large cows, but you don't eat small cows? I mean, it doesn't really make any sense. But on a more fundamental level, my veganism is a fundamental aspect of who I am as a human being. I am very, very deeply committed to nonviolence. It is a part of, a very important, perhaps the most important part of my life. I have been committed to nonviolence for many years. I am an abolitionist. I do not believe we should engage in any animal exploitation. I don't think we should be trying to regulate animal torture to make it more humane. I think we should be trying to abolish animal exploitation. And veganism is the application of the principle of abolition and the principle of nonviolence to the life of the individual. I begin my nonviolent life every day with what I put in my mouth. Abolitionism, veganism, nonviolence, they're all connected, and they're an integral part of who I am as a person. I also think veganism is better for you on a health basis, but we can get into that later.
Okay, great. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit farther than I had imagined, just because I think it's a good follow-up question to what Gary was just saying. Currently there's a lot of emphasis on ethical eating and what that means. And the 100-mile diet comes to mind right away is something that's quite popular as people are becoming more conscious of fuel consumption and issues like bioregionalism. So I'm curious, what is more ethical from each of your perspectives? A vegan diet that's perhaps coming, those products are perhaps coming from all over the world, or a diet that includes some animal products but perhaps uses less fuel and has potentially less of an ecological impact. So I'm going to turn it back over to Gary, and then we'll come back to Ray.
Well, I'm not a utilitarian or a consequentialist, so the fact that, I mean, I won't eat flesh or dairy or eggs. If I have to go without food and constrict my intake of calories dramatically because I don't have those foods available, that's what I will do. But the idea that I would eat an animal product because it was produced closer to where I live rather than eating a vegetable product that required some fossil fuel to bring to me, I'm not a consequentialist. I'm not a utilitarian. I am very, very much a what we call a deontological rights thinker. I do not believe we have moral right to engage in the consumption of flesh, dairy, egg, or any other animal product. We obviously always ought to try to walk lightly on the earth as much as we possibly can. And so I'm not in any way saying that we should not, that we shouldn't do so. But I would also point this out. Even when you have locally produced products that are, you know, animal products that require less fossil fuel, they invariably require greater consumption of resources. I mean, you know, meat takes between 6 and 12 pounds of plant protein to produce 1 pound of flesh. So you may, in one sense, be using less fossil fuel in one way, but you are consuming other resources in other ways. But I don't think the argument works. It doesn't resonate. And I hope, Lauren, we will come back to the first part of the question, which is different from the second. You know, you asked about the 100-mile diet issue. That's really very different from this whole issue of being a conscientious omnivore, which I think is an extremely problematic notion, and I hope we'll come back to that.
We'll definitely will. Thanks very much, Gary. All right, so I think Carl's going to rephrase the question again, and we'll ask.
Yeah, so Ray, what would you say if someone were to say to you, you know, I would want to be vegan, but I also want to eat this 100-mile diet, and I feel like consuming less fossil fuels or that sort of thing is more important to me than an ethical responsibility towards animals.
My first response that I had when I heard it echoes a lot of what Gary said, and that is that if you just look at the transportation issue, that's a very narrow way of looking at it, that the amount of resources that are consumed in animal agriculture are far beyond what are consumed in a plant-based diet, and I don't think that at all it balances it out if you say, okay, well, I'm going to get only food that's grown within 100 miles of where I live, or, you know, I don't think that it balances it out. So, you know, I mean, the UN has already determined that animal agriculture is the number one cause of global warming. So I would say that by choosing a plant-based diet, you're doing much more good. And it's also a very black and white way to look at it. And I know that people do say this, but it's very black and white. You can have a plant-based diet where you are also choosing foods that are grown locally as much as possible. And so it's, I don't feel like it's one or the other. Oh, I'm either going to do something, I'm either going to have a diet that's locally grown foods, or I'm going to, you know, have a plant-based diet and it's going to be all imported. That I think that you can find a balance there where you do have a plant-based diet and it's locally grown as much as possible.
I'm realizing, too, as we're asking these questions, of course, with both of your approaches that I've heard over the years and read, that you often solicit more information from people when they ask you questions like this to get at some of the assumptions that are underlying the question. So in many ways, what we're doing on the show today is somewhat artificial. So I thank you both for doing this exercise with us. So let's go back then to Gary's question that he wants to address, which is certainly something that's coming up over and over again. So why be vegan when so-called humanely produced meat and dairy is now available in stores? So back to you, Gary.
Well, I mean, I think this is nonsense. I think, first of all, I think that this whole conscientious omnivore movement is deceptive. It suggests that animal products are being produced in ways that result in the significant protection of animal interests. I think that that is an empirical matter, absolutely false. But it also really just doesn't address the fundamental question. Is it morally acceptable to eat animals, however humanely we treat them? And what troubles me about this conscientious omnivore movement is that it's moving the question over to the treatment side of the issue rather than the use side of the issue. In my book that's coming out from Columbia University, Animals as Persons, I talk about this whole thing, about the distinction between animal use and animal treatment, and that the animal rights perspective focuses on animal use, says that we have no right to use animals, however well we treat them, and I don't think we treat them very well, but the welfarist perspective focuses on treatment, and says, well, it's all right to use them as long as we treat them well. But I think this whole conscientious omnivore movement is very, very dangerous. It's deluding people into believing that animal products can be produced in a, quote, humane, end quote, way. I think that's nonsense. It's encouraging people to eat more animal products. We have this bizarre phenomenon now where we have large animal organizations promoting the animal compassionate labels of Whole Foods or the certified humane raised and handled label of the Humane Society of the United States and the ASPCA, those organizations. I mean, when you have animal organizations like PETA, like HSUS, when you have people like Peter Singer saying you can be a conscientious omnivore, you can eat animals in a particular way and discharge your moral obligations to them, I can tell you one thing, and it doesn't take a very high IQ or many degrees to come to the conclusion, that's exactly what people will do. And the empirical evidence we are seeing is that a lot of people who are moving in the vegetarian vegan direction are now moving back because they're being told they can consume animals in a humane way.
So Ray, why are you vegan when so-called humanely produced meat and dairy is available in a store near you?
Mm-hmm. First, I have to say that ditto to everything that Gary said. I'm on the same page, exact same page when it comes to this idea of, like, this stamp of approval for supposedly humanely raised, that I have seen time and time again people turning away from vegetarianism and justifying it by saying, oh, yes, but I only buy organic or humanely raised meat, you know, compassionately raised meat. And for most of these people, I only have to ask one question to find out that they don't do that 100% of the time. I say, oh, and do you ever go out to eat? Well, yes. Oh, do you only go to restaurants that have humane meat? Well, no. Do you eat meat when you're there? Well, yes. There isn't consistency within the consumer group, for one, that they will occasionally, when they're in a grocery store, buy this humanely raise meat, but they do go out to eat. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is that the labels mean nothing. I have visited many of these places that have the humanely raised or organic label on them. And one example is a turkey farm in New Mexico where all these folks in northern New Mexico say, oh, Ray, we're having turkey at Thanksgiving because it's from this particular farm that has organic turkeys. And so a friend and I went there to visit. And the reality of the situation was that nobody who is buying those birds frozen and wrapped in cellophane could have stomached what we saw on this farm. The birds are still specially bred to get to their full weight in 18 weeks. Many of them had broken legs because their legs couldn't handle the weight and they were dying and starving, and other birds were pecking at them. The conditions were not that different in this farm. They were fed supposedly healthier feed, but the conditions for those animals was horrible. You know, the way they were killed, they were, the person who kills them is called the harvester. They have all these kind names for people, and the harvester proudly told us about his very $100 very sharp knife, and he puts them upside down in wall funnels with their heads hanging out the bottom, and he first bleeds them. He cuts their main arteries in their neck so the blood comes out so that the next step is tidier. And it takes 2 minutes for them to bleed out. They're fully conscious and breathing during that 2 minutes. And if you ever time 2 minutes, it's a very long time. It's not a short period of time. And to be hanging upside down in a funnel being bled out during that 2 minutes. So I think that the labels are false and that they do give people permission to turn away from compassion, to get lazy about living their values of caring.
That's a good place to maybe go to a break. I wanted to come back and ask a question to both of you about privilege and veganism, because it's often positioned as this classist diet that only certain people within a certain economic bracket could afford to eat vegan, and some of those other critiques around privilege. So we're going to take a short break. Today you're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. We're doing a show called Vegans on the Hot Seat, and we're asking Ray Sikora and Gary Francione to respond to some of the commonly asked questions to vegans and animal rights people. Please stay tuned to Animal Voices, CIUT. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices CIUT. We just took a short break there for a station identification. I want to welcome Gary Francione and Ray Sikora back to the program. It's amazing to have you both on the show at the same time. Your favorite guests of the Animal Voices program, and to have you both together on the show is a real treat for us, so thank you.
Thank you. Treat for
thank
me
you
too.
Very much. All right, so the question that we had, I know that we're not able to do very much follow-up here, but I wanted to ask about Western privilege and class privilege, because that's something certainly a concern, I think, often coming from people within different social justice movements that see veganism as being a diet that comes out of a perspective that is an ability of Western people primarily and middle class or upper middle class people to be able to make certain food choices that would eschew things like meat and dairy. So it's not really a question, it's sort of a sort of more general response. How do you respond to people who think that it is a classist diet or particularly Western somehow, and that not everyone can make those kinds of choices? Well, how about we'll go with Gary and we'll come back to you, Ray.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting that you raised this, because Anna Charlin and I have just finished teaching human rights and animal rights this past semester at Rutgers. We taught that course, I think, for the second. We teach an animal rights course every semester, but I think this was the first or second time we did human rights and animal rights. And that issue about the privilege of veganism came up, and I must say I found it kind of, I was amazed, and I told the students, I said, now think about this. A diet based on animal agriculture involves an enormously selfish consumption of the world's resources. 6 to 12 pounds of protein for every pound of flesh, 1,000 times more water. We're destroying the environment. We're destroying the topsoil. We're feeding enough grain in this country alone to animals that we are going to slaughter to give 2 loaves of bread to every human being on the planet. How can anybody possibly say that the vegan diet, which consumes far fewer resources and makes diet that we've all been told is a good thing. And it shows, and actually your question really, and the sorts of questions I was getting, we were getting from our students, really shows how well the meat and the dairy industries have brainwashed people, including people on the left who ought to know better. And ultimately, I think, you know, part of the problem is a lot of people, and some of them are on the left, and some of them are progressive, and some of them should know better, don't want to give up animal products. They're committed to environmentalism as an abstract matter. They're committed to nonviolence as an abstract matter. But when you confront them with the violence and the ecological degradation and the health problems of an animal-based diet and how this is going to require some real changes in their lives other than, you know, some of the social events they choose to go to or whatever, then they back away from that. They don't want to make those individual choices or those individual changes. And I think that that's got a lot to do with it.
So, Ray, how would you respond to that allegation that that the vegan diet is somehow classist or racist or that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. I agree with Gary that most of the people who bring that up are the people who want an excuse to not give up animal products. I think that, you know, ideally, I would see the animal rights movement, including, you know, veganism and everything else that goes along with animal compassion, would join the peace movement and would join other social justice movements, because there's so many parallels, and how can you say you care about peace and continue to eat tortured beings? But I see it all the time. And just like Gary said, it's a little bit shocking that people who have such an open mind to other social justice issues don't have an open mind to this one. And what I've realized is it's very easy to say, oh, I really care about the people in Darfur, or I really care about the people in Iraq, and I really care about this. And it's easy to say that because it doesn't require you to make any changes under your own roof. You can talk about it, but your daily choices are not really affected by it. And I think that that is the difference with this. It's what are your choices and what are your priorities, and are you living a life that really reflects your values? And if your values are truly nonviolence, it should be reflected under your own roof, not just in the organizations that you support. So I don't really see it as a class issue, but I have heard people bring it up, and I do think it's a form of laziness about just laziness about living our values. And I've personally chosen to simplify my life way down, and maybe that's a class privilege too. I live on about $10,000 a year. I live like a queen on that, and I've been eating a vegan diet for many, many decades now, so I don't see them as opposing. You don't have to be a wealthy person to choose this diet.
Okay, here I've got another question for you both then. Isn't veganism difficult, though? I mean, don't you miss cheese or milk or those hamburgers and those barbecues? So, Ray, maybe we'll turn it back over to you, and then we'll come back to Gary.
Okay, my answer often to this will be shocking to many vegans. It often is. I think in a way, in terms of, like, emotions and what I love the taste of, I'm just a natural carnivore. I am, you know, like, I'm one of those people who buys those fake meats, and I love it. And so I think, in a way, like emotionally, it's not the best thing for me. Health-wise, I know, and I would never support the animal industries and all the suffering and violence involved, but I do miss cheese. And it's even after all these years. It's actually been 30 years now that I've been vegan, and I still miss cheese, and I don't know if I miss the reality of cheese. Maybe if I tasted it, I would really not like it at all. So when people say that to me, I say my choices are not about, you know, the fact that, oh, I don't even like cheese, or, oh, I don't even like meat. It's not about that for me. It's about, oh, I want to be consistent with my values. So, yes, I miss those things. And who knows, you know, if I had the opportunity to eat cheese, I might not like it at all. It's been so many years. So I think it's just these emotional memories that we have of good times and foods that satisfy something emotionally. I do have that.
But is it difficult then to give up those things?
In the beginning, it was very difficult for me. I really wanted to be a chegan, which is what I call a cheating vegan. I was a vegan, you know, quite a few times in the beginning. I was like, oh, you know, nobody's around to see me and it won't make a difference this time. And afterwards, I would realize, oh, that momentary pleasure I got was followed by kind of beating up on myself because I knew what I was supporting by eating that. And then I realized, oh, it's not worth it for that momentary pleasure. So then I stopped being a vegan. And I also found that my meals are much more interesting now, and people love the food that I cook. And before, you know, I liked to have people over a lot, and I thought, oh, I don't know what to make that'll be interesting. In the beginning, it was tricky. It was like learning a new ethnic style of cooking. And once I learned it, I thought, wow, it is limitless, the amount of variety and the wonderful foods that I cook. And people love to come over, you know, even carnivores love to come to my place for Thanksgiving and different holidays because the best food around.
Thanks for that, Ray. We're going to give Gary a little bit more time because we gave you a little bit more time and asked that follow-up question. So, Gary, we still have you on the line?
I'm probably going to give you a shorter answer, so maybe the extra time to sort of fill in something else.
We're going to move into right soon, so we'll let you have more time with that.
Anna and I have been vegans for 25 years. We have never knowingly consumed an animal product in that time. When we first became vegans in 82, it was a little difficult. I still remember the first vegan ice cream or soy ice cream that I ever ate, and it was so horrible. I still remember it was one of the most terrible things that you could possibly eat. But, you know, it's no longer difficult now. I have become a consumer of a lot of raw foods. I've gone to about an 80% raw food diet. And I didn't really do that intentionally. It just sort of evolved, and I feel great. My 53 and have more energy than most of my students were young enough to be my children. I've got, you know, low blood pressure, low cholesterol, and all of the things that other members of my family don't have. And so I, you know, I don't find it all that difficult. I don't miss meat. I've been in enough slaughterhouses and dairy farms and egg places, and I've seen enough of it so that the association of that stuff in my mind. And I don't mean to in any way criticize, I mean, this is more of an aesthetic thing than a moral thing, and I'm not in any way criticizing the fact that Ray doesn't have that aesthetic reaction. It's an aesthetic issue. It just, for me, the experiences I've had in being in these places and seeing what animal products really mean, what an egg really means, what cheese really means, it's so associated, that stuff in my mind, with those images that, frankly, when I'm in a place where I smell meat being cooked, it actually causes me to become nauseated. So I don't miss that stuff at all. I don't buy fake meat products. When I take my friends to restaurants that have mock meats, you know, some of these Chinese places have these mock meats, I never order those sorts of foods because, you know, again, I don't think there's anything morally wrong with them. It's just I have a physical sort of revulsion to them. But no, it is not hard to be a vegan. In 2007, anybody who says it's hard to be a vegan ain't paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree.
All right, well, we're going to move now to a discussion of rights. We have about 15 more minutes left, and I wanted to...
You need longer shows.
I know.
That's what I was thinking.
I want to ask about what rights means to both of you. So I'll phrase it this way. In a typical question is often, do you think that animals should have the same rights as people? And the follow-up question usually is something like, and do you think that the life of a mouse is as important as the life of a human?
Of course I don't think that animals should have the right to necessarily drive a car or drive a powerboat. You know, there's certain rights, of course, that I don't think that we share with other species. But I do think the basic rights to have a life as much as possible without suffering. I mean, even our human lives have suffering, but as much as possible to not have unnecessary suffering inflicted on our lives, on their lives, is a very basic right. To have a right to a healthy home, to have a right to make choices, to love and to mate, and all these different parts of life that really make life rich. They're not unique to humans. And so I do think that in that way that those rights, so I wouldn't make the blanket statement that animals should have all the exact same rights that we have, because of, you know, some of those rights involve things that animals have no interest in doing and we probably wouldn't want to see them doing. But in general, the ones that are basically like, oh, what is a good life for a bat? What is a good life for a chicken? That they should be allowed to have those, the right to have those lives, and to be self-determining about when possible. They should be able to determine, ah, this is what I want. In this moment, I want this, without someone taking away those joys in their life and some of the basic things that we assume we get in our lives. And I think a lot of this is, a lot of times people will write off other species based on intelligence, but who's writing the intelligence test for them? You know, we're writing the intelligence test and then saying they're not intelligent, when in fact we don't have the intelligence often to understand their world. And I think I've said something similar to this to you before, Lauren. If a bat were writing the intelligence test, they would say, okay, you know, move through this woods as fast as you can in the dark and don't hit anything. You know, and we'd be bumbling idiots, you know, and we would fail miserably and they'd go, oh yes, it's those unintelligent humans. You know, they can't do the most basic things in life.
Obviously, you know, when asked, do I think humans and animals ought to have the same rights? Well, if you think about it, that's a pretty dumb question. I mean, think about it for a second. What is a right? A right is a way of protecting an interest. We all have interests. Humans and non-humans have interests. There are things that we prefer or desire or want. Rights are ways of protecting those interests. And what they a right basically says that an interest is protected against being taken away for consequential reasons. If I have a right of free speech, it means that my interest in self-expression will be protected even if other people don't like the substance of what I say. That's really what a right means. I mean, it would get a lot more complicated, but Lauren hasn't yet gotten a longer show, so we can't. But as far as what rights animals ought to have, my view is, as I've expressed in Introduction to Animal Rights, I only talk about one right, the right not to be treated as property. Animals ought to have that one right, the right not to be treated as economic resources. To talk about animals having other rights, the rights to drive, the right to go to university, the right to vote, although we might have better electoral results, those sorts of rights make no sense. I mean, those are interests that animals don't have. But animals do share, all sentient beings do share in common an interest in not being treated as an economic commodity or as a resource, and so therefore I argue that as long as an animal is sentient, and I don't care what other cognitive characteristics they have, I don't care if they, you know, can add two and two or what sorts of results they produce in intelligence tests and things like that, I don't care about any other characteristic, self-awareness, rationality, ability to use abstract concepts, as long as they are sentient, then they ought to have the right not to be treated as the commodities of humans. Now, of course, that leads to a rather dramatic conclusion, and that is we ought to stop bringing domestic animals into existence. The issue is not ought we to be treating them well. I mean, we obviously, you know, it's always better to inflict less harm than more harm. But in my view, if we respected the right of animals not to be treated as commodities, we would stop bringing domestic animals into existence, including dogs and cats. We would stop bringing all domestic animals into existence that are used as our resources and as our commodities. Now, as far as your question, is the life of a mouse more important than the life of a human being? I find that question no different from somebody saying to me, is the life of this human being worth more than the life of that human being? I don't even know what that question means when I am asked it concerning two human beings. Two human beings both value their lives. They value their lives whether I value their lives or whether you value their lives. They value themselves even if no one else values them. The mouse's life is important to the mouse. The mouse values the mouse's own interests, whatever they may be. And to talk about whether or not a mouse's life is more important than the life of a human is, in my judgment, one of those questions which, when you unpack it, doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, and you don't even have to get to the mouse. It doesn't about it in the context of human beings.
All right. Thanks for that, Gary.
Can I just say ditto, ditto, ditto to all that, too?
We should have a ditto button or something.
Yeah, absolutely. That was
ditto
great.
All right. Well, we only have about 10 more minutes left, and I want to ask a question that I think in some ways is just such a difficult one for me anyway to grapple with. And this is a question about religious texts. So people will say things like, but doesn't the Bible tell us or other religious texts tell us that using animals or eating animals is okay? So I'm going to turn that over to Ray, and then we'll come back with Gary.
Well, I think that religious text and the Bible, number one, they were written by humans. And you can take, you know, religious text from the various religions, and you can find in some religious text where animals are to be treated as our equals. You can find religious text that can be interpreted however someone wants to. In the Bible, certainly, the Christian Bible, you can find text in there that if you have five people, they will interpret it five different ways in order to support their own views and what they want to do in their own lives. So as far as I'm concerned, none of that religious text holds more power than who and what do you really care about and how does it look in your life. Some people look at the Bible and they say, oh, we have dominion over the animals. And some people look at the very same sentence and say, oh, we're stewards of this place, so we're supposed to care for them, not have power over them. And none of that really matters. I think that it can become this intellectual, religious debate that keeps people from looking into their own hearts, that keeps people from looking into who and what do you care about deeply. Now let's look at your life. How does it show up in your life? Regardless of what any book says or any human who came before you, what do you care about? Who do you care about? And now live a life that reflects that.
Okay, Gary, over to you.
The answer I would give to that is, first of all, if you look at the Bible, look at Genesis, there's a very interesting story in the beginning of Genesis where it appears as though God gives only plant material to humans to eat, that nobody's killing or eating anyone else. As a matter of fact, if I could reach my Bible, which is over on my bookshelf, which is out of the range of my head microphone, I would read it to you. But there's a very interesting, the first creation story does not involve any killing. Killing starts after Adam and Eve are driven from the Garden of Eden as a result of a conspiracy between a woman and a snake, are banished from the Garden of Eden, and then killing begins, number one. Number two, as Ray points out, you can look at any religious text, I don't care what it is, and find support for all sorts of really terrible things. And you can also find support for great aspirational virtues of love and of compassion. And you can also find in the 19th century, the Old Testament was used to justify slavery, and with good reason. There's a lot of slavery in the Old Testament. So you've got to be careful. I mean, I always, when people start pointing to religious texts, I always caution them about the smorgasbord approach to morality, and that it might be a good idea. You know, people want to do certain things, and they say, ah, well, I have textual support here. Well, yes, and in three pages earlier, I could show you textual support for something that you would absolutely reject. So it really can't be just what the book says, because you accept certain things and reject certain things. So really what becomes important is not what the book says, but what are your moral principles about what you accept and what you don't accept.
Thank you, Gary. So Ray, one of the questions that are for both Ray and Gary, but we'll go to Ray first. One of the questions that I've faced numerous times is a real doozy. And, it's one of those questions that puts you on the defensive right away because of its absurdity. So, what about plants? Don't plants feel pain too when you pull a carrot from the ground and when you chop down a tree? Don't they yell and don't they?
Mm-hmm. Of course, I've gotten this question many, many times, and I say, you know, ideally, I would live a life that harms nothing and no one. I would be a breatharian, and still, I would be harming organisms who live in the air. So what I do is I don't think that there really that there is such a thing as a life that causes no harm. I mean, it's part of being a living being, you know, that there is some suffering that goes on to keep me alive. So in the course of that, I can't look at, okay, I'm going to live a life that causes no harm. What I do is say, ah, how can I cause the least harm possible? And the way to cause the least harm possible, ah, let me consume at least as few plants as I can. And since it takes so many plants to create that little bit of animal protein, I love that I'm saving all of these plants by eating a plant-based diet. I'm saving plants. So that is usually my response to it, because it's pretty basic that, you know, plants are wasted when they're recycled through living beings in order to create animal products.
And what about you, Gary?
Ray, do you think that plants are sentient in any way?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, then we have found our first disagreement in this entire show. No, I don't think plants are sentient at all. I mean, they don't have nervous systems. They don't have benzodiazepine receptors. They don't have any of the characteristics that we associate with sentience. Plants don't have minds. There's nothing that a plant prefers or desires or wants. And I think it's very, very, very problematic when we start talking about the sentience of plants, because if we start talking about the sentience of plants, then it makes it a lot easier for somebody to say, well, you know, I really am concerned, you know, but you're going to eat those Brussels sprouts, and those Brussels sprouts are sentient. I'm going to eat a piece of fish or some chicken, you know, and then you end up getting into an argument about whether the chicken or the fish are more sentient than the Brussels sprout, which is something which is a discussion that is too surreal for me at this point in my life. So I don't think that plants, there is no indication whatsoever that plants are sentient or experience pain. And now, I don't think we should waste them, but that's not because I think we have any obligation to the plant. I think we have an obligation to other humans. I mean, you know, if you're sitting there and you've got a bunch of plants, why waste them when you can share them with other people who can eat them? But that's an obligation that I owe to other humans to help nourish them. That's not an obligation that I owe, you know, that I owe to the plants. Whereas, with respect to sentient beings, whatever those beings are, my moral obligation runs directly to them. I have a moral obligation that I owe directly to them, not to exploit them. So I would say that there's a real big difference. And this is something that troubles me a lot, because there are a lot of animal people who do subscribe to the sentience, the plants are sentient paradigm, and then that makes it virtually impossible to talk about veganism, because then you've got really nothing to say to the person who says, well, you're eating that lettuce salad, and I'm going to have some ice cream, and we're both causing suffering, and who knows which of us is causing really more suffering. I bought my ice cream at Whole Foods, this humanely certified ice cream. Who knows who's causing more suffering? And my answer to that is always, I don't care where your ice cream comes from. It causes suffering. And as far as I know, at this point in my life, and in terms of scientific knowledge, you can do whatever you want to with lettuce. And I think, you know, and I think in a sense, we all recognize that intuitively. If you got somebody sitting at a table and you bring a rabbit over, a live rabbit, and you start chopping the rabbit up, that person's going to have a very, very different response from if you bring a cabbage over to the table and start chopping up the cabbage. No one's going to say anything. The conversation will continue. Because in a sense, we all recognize that, you know, plants may be alive, but that doesn't mean they're sentient. There's a huge difference between being alive and being sentient.
Can I go? Do we have time for me to go back to my response?
We are out of time. Yeah.
We're out of time. This is so unfair.
And we didn't even get to insects. I was hoping we would get to insects.
Well, hopefully we'll have you both on the program again. In just the last 2 seconds that we don't even have left, did we get to some of the commonly asked questions that you both find is on the top of your list? Did we hit some of the major ones at least?
Yeah, you hit some of the major ones. I mean, I discussed a lot of them in my book and in my website, www.abolitionistapproach.com, but there are many more of them. We right. not exhaustible to hear.
Well, we might have to make this a series. It was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, Ray, what about you? Did we get some of the common questions that you're asked?
Yeah, I think that you hit a lot of the common ones. I think I'm used to hearing the intelligence question a lot, probably because I write material on animal intelligence, but that's why I get that one.
Well, thanks to both of you for being on the program today. It was a lot of fun. I did a lot more laughing than I thought that I would. just because these are sometimes really difficult questions for people to grapple with. But you both bring so many years of experience, and I really want to thank you both deeply again for being on the program.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, well, you've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. We were just speaking with Ray Sikora, founder of the organization Simply Enough. If you're interested in hearing more about Ray, you can go to our website, animalvoices.ca, or go to her website, simplyenough.com. And we were also speaking with Professor Gary Francione. And if you're interested in more of his work, you can go to www.abolitionistapproach.com. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner, and I apologize for going over time.